You're listening to The Moment, an interview podcast series on life. We interview and capture conversations with creative minds, thought leaders, disruptors, and the people that are doing what they love while challenging the status quo. You can find the show notes on our website, themomenthq.com, and follow us on Instagram and Facebook. But for now, let's dive into The Moment. Hello and welcome to the Monica Cade podcast, episode number 60. My guest today is Stephen Fennelly, who has worked in and around the media for more than three decades as a journalist, broadcaster and communications consultant. His career began in 1977 at the Sydney Daily Telegraph, and since then he has reported news and current affairs nationally and internationally. He's worked as a presenter and reporter on various ABC arts programs, and for the past 11 years has focused a lot on media training and consulting. He's had an incredible career thus far, and today he's going to share some personal insights on how he got to where he is and what the adventure has entailed. So let's dive in. Hello, Stephen. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Monica. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So for the listeners who aren't familiar about your journey, I thought it would be interesting to share what is your first memory of having a love for journalism and media?
It's a very interesting thing because I had not set out to be a journalist. In fact, when I left school, I was intent on being an actor. And I'd enrolled in an acting course, and which I was paying for because my father wasn't happy with me being an actor, and he certainly wasn't going to fund it. So I was working full-time, enrolled in a course at the Ensemble in Sydney under the great Hayes Gordon and Zeke Nesta. And I discovered very, very quickly into that course, largely because of trying to have a full-time job plus do a full-time acting course, that I really didn't have what it took to be an actor. And I saw some very dedicated people around me who were prepared to live off the smell of an oily rag and to pretty much almost starve themselves to fulfill their dreams. And I had a bourgeois thing about eating. So I thought, I'm not sure that's really for me. Anyway, I went through a period in the first year out of school of quite frankly not knowing what I wanted to do. And strangely, early in that sort of around about September or so, and I was completely at a loose end. In fact, I was on the dole because I'd left the acting course. I'd lost the job, the full-time job that I had in order to support the acting course, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine was in the dole office in Surry Hills, and she saw me coming in, and she kept seeing me knock back jobs to sell suits or to sell shoes and God knows what else. And she said to me in the pub one night, "You know, I reckon we're going to take you off the dole if you keep knocking back these jobs we keep sending you to." And I said to her, "You know what? I actually thought the other night about being a journalist." And she said, "Oh, yeah, good luck, mate. You know, you're knocking back jobs to sell suits." You know? And I said, "I was actually listening to a Peter Frampton record the other night and had this idea maybe I could be a journalist." And quite frankly, at that point, I wasn't even quite clear exactly what it was a journalist did except write stories. And strangely enough, through the dole office, and I think I'm the only person who can claim that I got my job through the Commonwealth Employment Service, a job came up for a copy boy at the Sydney Daily Telegraph because midway through the year they'd lost one of their number, and instead of having the heavy enrolment where you have 70 people apply, one person gets the gig, I was coming in on a one-off because they needed to fill a spot as a copy boy. And I wrote an essay, they gave me the job. And that's basically a mad kicker's job. You being a copy boy is the lowest of the lowest in newspapers, but it's also where most journalists in those days started. And there was an old saying, "Don't kick the copy boy because he could be your editor one day," which turned out to be true many, many times. But copy boys were the people who got the coffee. They broke up the copy in those days that journalists wrote that in those days were written on multiple carbons before we had computers. And we were running up and downstairs from the compositor's room to the newsroom and back and forth running copy around the place. Copy, for people who don't know about journalism, is actually the written word. It's the what you write on paper before it gets printed, and now you put it to computer and it gets automatically printed. It's a much, much faster process. But in those days, paper was everything, and having the copy boy running around doing errands, that's how you got to start in print. And I did that for 12 months, then I was given a cadetship, and before the end of my cadetship, one of my old bosses in newspapers, the great Cliff Neville, who is no longer with us, regrettably. He offered me my first job in television. He later went on to be a producer at 60 Minutes, but at those days he was chief of staff of the newly appointed chief of staff of the newsroom at Channel 7, and he brought a lot of newspaper journalists in order to bolster the journalistic quality in commercial television. And there was a real renaissance. People might forget this, but there was a real renaissance in commercial television in the early 80s that infused certainly 9 and 7, but also to some degree Channel 10, where there was real quality, some extraordinary people like Kerry O'Brien, Graham Davis, Paul Lynham, you know, people who went on to become big names, well, Ray Martin, people like that, who were very, very good journalists either at the ABC or in print, turned up to commercial television and really lifted the standard. And it was a real golden era all the way through the 80s for journalism, real journalism in commercial television, something that regrettably has been sorely lacking for the last couple of decades.
What an incredible story. And so can I just go back to when, you know, you started your being the copy boy and then even your cadetship?
Yeah.
Because you went into this with just kind of, I guess, on inspiration and gut instinct that this was the path that you wanted to take. Did you find that you had to really hone your skill, or was it something that came to you naturally?
No, absolutely. I mean, I tell you, I got inspired, and like most kids my age, I was 18 at the time, and everybody around me was reading All the President's Men because, you know, Woodward and Bernstein had finally written the novel that became the film, written the book that became the film, and it was written like a novel, although it was actually a documentary account of the Watergate scandal. But we all read that, and that put fire in our bellies, and we all wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein. So that certainly gave me the inspiration, but I got to tell you, I found the business of writing really hard, and I found the whole idea of structuring a sentence for tabloid, which is actually a really good skill to learn, but it is a skill, that took me a long time to master, and I was a very slow writer. I got quicker over time, but I was a very slow writer. I mean, I was taking particular care, but to write copy for a tabloid newspaper is a fantastic skill, not because you're writing sensationally. I mean, that is a quality or a characteristic of tabloid, regrettably, but it's also good, succinct information at its best. And once you get past the front pages of the tabloids, there's often very good journalism inside the papers. I mean, I'm not sure if I'd necessarily say that in 2018 as much as I would have said it, say, 20 years ago. But, you know, there was some very good, solid journalism inside the tabloids. But what was great about them is that they were, you know, written in a very succinct and direct way. And I'm glad that I developed that skill, but it is very much a skill. And that's why a lot of people call journalism a trade more than they call it a profession. I think there's a, you know, I probably fall between two camps as to whether it's a profession or a trade. I think it's like anything, you need to operate professionally, but there is a craft that you can actually learn.
Why do you think that, because you just mentioned that there's been the journalism back in the day was probably much more succinct and more so better, I suppose. Would you say so?
Well, I think there's been a slow path for this, but I mean, I became disillusioned, bitterly disillusioned with what I was doing in the early 90s, and I quit mainstream journalism, if you like, at the end of 91. I was a US correspondent for the Nine Network, and I saw a dramatic change over the time that I was in the United States in the way my own network treated news and current affairs, and I certainly did not want to continue in that environment where I saw an active dumbing down of the content and far less interest in stories that mattered to people in a democracy and a much greater focus on the more sensational sort of aberrant stories around crime and punishment and everything else, or, you know, entertainment stories, than on those stories that really mattered in order for people to make decisions in their life about the country and the society they live in. Something I thought that commercial television had been very good at, and it stopped being good at it, and I didn't want to be a part of it anymore, so I got out. And so it was like the end of a love affair. I mean, I really loved what I did. I was very, very passionate about what I did. I loved the thrill of the chase. I loved all the romance of journalism. Mm. And when it stopped being that and when it became a kind of race to the bottom, I wanted to get out of certainly doing it in a mainstream fashion.
Mm. It's nice to know that you followed that instinct, though, because I feel a lot of people sometimes recognise that they're unhappy with a particular career path, but they don't always take the action to move out of it because, yes, there is a bit of a romance with whatever you've been through and whatever you've created for yourself up until a certain point. But I think it's nice that you were able to really, you know, trust your gut instinct on that and move away from it.
Well, it was a crisis. I mean, admittedly, I was in a position at the time where I was able to do it, and it really came down to having you know, I won't use the expletive, but, you know, there's the old notion of FU money. Hmm. And I had cash in the bank. And it wasn't a lot of cash, but it was enough to sustain me for quite a period of time in order to take a significant cut in what I was earning to be able to pursue the things that I wanted to do. And it really was quite a dramatic shift. I mean, I went from being this sort of, you know, bouffant-haired, you know, besuited, you know, TV reporter, you know, suiting the microphone, to becoming a complete boho, living in Darlinghurst and, you know, making short films and hanging out in galleries and, in fact, opening stupidly but fantastically great fun, stupidly financially, opening my own gallery, starting to hang out with filmmakers. I won the first Tropicana Film Festival. I mean, it was a very different thing then. It was a very much an event on the street where the police were trying to move us on because we were slowing down the traffic, to the great spectacle that it's become today. But, you know, so I suddenly had a very, very different, took a very different direction in life and was very glad that I did it. But I suffered financially for it. It wasn't the smartest move financially.
Mm. So then what was it that really, what was your love for the arts? You know, why did you want to move in towards that direction?
Well, I suppose in some way I was trying to get back to what I'd originally, was originally interested in, and that was theatre. But strangely enough, and particularly this had a lot to do with my time in America, where I was spending a lot of time with artists and spending a lot of time in galleries and really was awakened to visual art. While I was over there and got very interested in painting and even attempted, you know, disastrously to dabble in it myself for a while. but I got very interested in painting and got very interested in painters. So I suppose rather than theatre, my approach, my gateway into art was via the visual arts. But then when I came back to Sydney, a lot of my cohort were filmmakers. And so, you know, basically the people I drank in Darlinghurst with were filmmakers. So there was also interest in film, although I wasn't passionately interested in film. I made short films more opportunistically than anything else, largely because of the impetus of John Paulson, who's still the artistic director of Tropfest. But he was part of our crowd and he was the one who G'd us all up. And in fact, it was through my gallery I was working. The first show I was going to do was with a very unusual artist, Michael Saker, who was very much a feature on the street at the Tropicana, and a very unusual, eccentric character, great character, very smart person, but also a person who was struggling materially. Anyway, I gave him a show in my gallery, and during the course of working up to the show, we made a film, which was essentially him just talking to camera, which I then cut up into, I recorded about 3 hours and I cut it up into 15 minutes as a short film. And it was his diatribe. And it was very funny and it touched a lot of people. And it was particularly meaningful for the people of Darlinghurst. I'm not sure how much it would have travelled beyond Darlinghurst, but certainly a lot of people knew Michael. And a lot of people found him a very funny person. He was a palm reader who would take the mickey out of palm reading. He was a palm reader who would take the mickey out of the people whose palms he was reading. Mm. He was somebody who was a great gadfly on the street because he took the mickey out of Darlinghurst life while embracing it fully himself. Mm. And he was a painter and a great, and I loved his painting and I've still got one of his pictures and I think he's still painting. I hope he's still painting.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. And tell me, what do you, in that sense, feel makes a good story? Because I feel from what you've shared so far, you know, you're just simply expressing your creativity in different forms, and it's changed over the years, but you've always had that creative spark right from the beginning of theatre.
Yeah, well, I certainly admire creative people, and I certainly love the escape and ability to reflect on life that art in whatever form, be it film or literature or theatre or visual art, gives you. And it's interesting because while I'm a journalist and I'm a complete news junkie, and I'm completely absorbed by daily events, my interest in art, strangely enough, was in abstraction, was in pictures that somebody who knew nothing about art once described to me as paintings without pictures in them, which is, while it's sort of is an uneducated approach to take, it's actually a rather poetic way of approaching abstraction.
Yeah.
That there's something that doesn't have to be about anything immediate, but is something that becomes a touchstone for reflection or whatever. And I loved abstraction. And I suppose I sought it out. But of course, once you go through that door, a lot of other doors open for you. And so there's, you know, lots of art, like agitprop art, agitation and propaganda art, art that is about the here and now, art that is campaigning art on a cause. There's that sort of art. There's lots of escapist kind of art in whatever form. And I suppose I have very broad tastes. But certainly what I wanted to move away from, which is interesting, is I wanted to move away from what was easy. I wanted to move away from what was sort of, you know, the not the lowest common denominator, but the things that were most popular didn't really appeal to me that much.
Mm-hmm.
I was much more interested in people who were exploring ideas for the sake of those ideas rather than whether or not they were going to get bums on seats. So it wasn't the easy get, if you like. And I suppose that was my whole relationship with journalism. I moved away from commercial television because I thought it had become obsessed with bums on seats or you know, getting eyeballs rather than actually keeping in mind what its responsibility was to tell a story that informed people and that made people better able to make decisions about their life. And that's probably an old romantic and old-fashioned view, but I still hold to it. And I still admire those journalists who have stuck it out and are still able to do that because they're tragically, there are less and less of them doing it.
Mm. Do you think that we will ever move back towards that type of reporting and news?
Well, we still see elements of it. I mean, there's still great journalistic platforms out there. I mean, you look at Four Corners, you look at the remnants of Fairfax with the people like Kate McClymont. You look at people like Peter Grester, who, although has moved into an academic position now in Queensland, is still a great advocate for that sort of journalism. You're seeing there's that outfit, that independent journalist outfit in Washington that is collaborating with journalists around the world and crowdsourcing and doing things like that to get stories up. So we're in a different environment now. I mean, the old traditional platforms are disappearing, and with that is a lot of great talent, you know, and people, very, very good journalists, taking redundancy because they probably have to get out before the thing that they're getting out from while it still exists, because it may not be there when their time comes to take redundancy. So, you know, for very sound, self-interested reasons, people are having to move on, and because they're getting old. But there are still, I still have great faith in the fact that, you know, truth will out and there will be journalists there, people who will be committed to do that. And, you know, I feel guilty in many ways because, I mean, quite frankly, 10 years ago I stepped away from journalism 100%. I stopped any journalism when I moved to London with my family. And because by that stage, well, certainly in the early 90s onward, I started doing media training and was very selective about how I did it, because one of the reasons I moved into arts journalism was by doing arts journalism, I could do media training at a corporate level and not have a conflict of interest and trade on my old background as a news journalist but not be conflicted by who I took on as clients. But even that became difficult as I moved into the noughties, where I found that certain work I was doing as an arts journalist, I was writing for Crikey, I had done a lot of work for the ABC, I was starting to come across situations where corporate clients were giving money to arts institutions, the very same institutions that I was scrutinising, and I was starting to get rub up against some conflicts there. And I really then had to make a choice. And the choice became a totally self-interested choice. I was making very, very little money out of journalism by that stage. I was doing it as a hobby. I was doing it as a love and a passion. And I had a very young family at the time, and I had to work out what I really needed to do from a, you know, survival point of view. So I pretty much stopped doing arts journalism at that point. That was 2006 going into 2007. But since then, I continue to do some pro bono and semi-pro bono work in the arts. I mean, helping arts institutions tell their own stories. But now, pretty much, I'm full-time as a communications consultant and media trainer. Mm. And that was a decision I made for a whole range of personal reasons about what was actually best for my family in the end, as freelance journalism became less and less viable. Mm. And it's a decision you don't make that decision lightly. It's not an easy decision to make, and it's one, if all things being equal, quite frankly, I'd still be a journalist.
Mm. In terms of your media training, I feel that today, especially with the social media revolution, I feel that almost anyone can, you know, present themselves as a presenter, or, you know, that everyone has the ability to communicate and write. And would you say that there is a need for more people to go through media training to deliver better quality content?
Well, it depends which way you look at media training. Are you looking at the storyteller on the journalist side, or are you looking at the people who are the subject side wanting to tell their story? I've actually had experience of working with both. Mm-hmm. I have worked with journalists, particularly as journalism itself is changing, where print journalists suddenly have to become broadcasters. They have to become presenters at public events, because some of the traditional platforms are moving into events as part of their business model, where their journalists are actually performing on stage, telling stories or conducting interviews on stage. So that has actually been a piece of what I've done, is actually helping journalists tell let a three-part drama unfold, if you like, while they're interviewing somebody in front of an audience, you know, which is quite a confronting experience if you haven't done that before. Mm. But the vast bulk of what I do is helping people in business, people in NGOs, people in government institutions tell stories when the filter is a journalist and they're having to, you know, do Q&A with a journalist in whatever medium, be it print or broadcast. But I have worked with some people who do podcasts. I think that, look, anybody, myself included, can benefit from training, can benefit from some taking time out to reflect on what they're doing to see if they can do it better. But do you know what's really good about the emergence of podcasts and whatever you want to call them, and all these independent platforms? We're discovering some really spot-on broadcasters. Mm. And, you know, and communicators, and who haven't come through that traditional realm. I mean, there's also a lot of rubbish out there, and that's the harder thing for the audience, is to find what is worthwhile. And also, you know, what we have seen, the really successful podcasters have ended up moving back into the mainstream, so you're hearing their voices on radio or, you know, in television, wherever. You know, there's a whole range of examples like that, and I suppose through public broadcasting you see a lot of it. So, you know, this is a very exciting firmament that is new media, traditional media taking on elements of new media, people from new media working in moving into traditional media. I mean, it's a big, heady mix.
Mm. I love that you're so open to it, and I love that you embrace both of it, and you can see the good stuff, and then you can, you know, just differentiate that from the stuff that may not be so engaging, because I know that there are people that could look at this and be like, oh, it's not like how it used to be, and reject what is.
Yeah, that's right. Look, there's some excellent stuff happening now. When you look at, you know, I look at programs. I mean, he's a good friend, but, you know, you look at programs like Richard Feidler's Conversations. You look at emerging things like The Conversation, which is a website that the universities have set up where they're getting academics to communicate. There's a whole range of things happening out there. I suppose there's a regret. There's both a celebration and a regret in this. One, it's fantastic. There's a greater diversity of voices. But what we have lost and what makes it difficult for us as a broader community to look at the same things is that we don't have the village green that we used to have before. I don't really remember. You go back to the 80s, on a Monday morning, people would be talking about what was on 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. Because so many people had watched 60 Minutes. Whereas the market has become so split up, if you like, and there's so many, it's been so heavily segmented that you don't have those common conversations like you used to. Now, there is a downside because we don't have the shared experience that we used to. But at the same time, we have a greater diversity of voices. We have a greater diversity of ideas. The only problem is we're self-selecting and we're going only to that which we agree with. So our prejudices and our beliefs probably aren't being challenged in the same way they were before. And I don't know what the solution to that is. I certainly would help if the social media platforms like Facebook were creating more open forums for us rather than Facebook only taking us to our friends and what our friends think, to be opening us up to a greater diversity of voices. And there is something happening with the algorithms with those platforms that is a problem. And so we need to challenge that. So we need, it would be good if we could create an environment where people are open to things they have not expected. Mm. And in a way, that's what a lot of traditional journalism did. It put things in your face for a broad audience, whether they liked it or not. Look, the tabloids probably didn't do that as much as the broadsheets did, but you had a curated paper. Now, there's good and bad in that. There's always good and bad in all of this because people would say, well, why should we leave it to the journalist as this great authority to dictate what it is we read? And there's some truth to that. But at the same time, people who are digging a lot harder than I am, I want to know what they're finding out and I want to go to that with an open mind. I do want people to still present to me the uncomfortable truth. And you won't do that if everything is based on an algorithm that brings all that's most popular to the top. And we're seeing this with the ABC at the moment even, where it's working on what the audience wants as opposed to what people decide the audience needs to know. And that sounds patronising almost. It sounds, you know, paternalistic. But at the same time, I give credit to people who do the digging. I give credit to people who spend their days looking for interesting ideas. And I want to give those people credit to be able to present me with those ideas. And they're the people I seek out when I'm seeking, whether I'm seeking them out online or whether I'm seeking them out in any medium, people who are going to show me things that I had not expected to see. And I think that in the way media is disintegrating into all these sort of discrete entities, that we're giving those discrete audiences what they want as opposed to sometimes what might be uncomfortable for them and what they need to know.
Mm.
And there is that tension.
I agree with you completely. Do you think now, because you do work with TED Talks, so do you feel like that maybe is opening up the platform to present new ideas to people that, you know, aren't so designated to that one particular area of popularity?
Well, that's finally when they make it up onto the TED platform, and you've still got to have an audience that's sufficiently open to go and look for it. But I know that as a curator at TED, and I sit on the curatorial team for TEDx Sydney, and we, in fact, just came from a meeting last night where we seek to challenge ourselves all the time and make very hard decisions about who we have doing the talking in terms of diversity of voice, in terms of ideas that people haven't heard before or have not been widely disseminated before, And it's not just TED. There's a whole range of platforms, speaking platforms like that. And that's one of the things that's emerged, for instance, this appetite, this hunger that people have for talk and ideas. You know, I've worked on this program that Sydney University does where it takes 20 academics out to 20 pubs across Sydney in one night, spreading ideas. Mm. I've done work for the University of New South Wales at the Grand Challenge, curating talks, working with academics who've been selected by the university to put the ideas of the university out there. At Sydney Opera House, Edwina Throsby, who was our curator at TED, she's now running a fantastic talks program at the Sydney Opera House. There's an absolute explosion of this because there is a hunger out there for those ideas that perhaps people aren't getting through their, you know, their normal media channels. I don't know how broad that hunger is, but if you look at, say, a program on National Public Radio in the States, which is very popular out here now, This American Life, it's enormously popular. Now, it's enormously popular in that it's got millions of viewers, but that's in a population of, you know, 300 million people. So I don't know how, like, mass popular it is, but there's certainly a sizable audience that has a hunger for that. So, you know, that's a whole other form of media, if you like, and then traditional media apes it. So if you look at, say, programs, again, I'll say, you know, Richard Feidler's Conversation is appealing, again, to that audience that wants to be able to delve into something a little bit more deeply and spend an hour looking at something, whereas, you know, we're now being told so often, you know, with whether it's online audiences, whether it's with TV audiences, that people's attention spans are getting shorter. Well, that may be in a lot of cases, but it's also an audience that actually wants to spend time ruminating on an idea and, you know, spending a little bit more time delving into that. So I think the thing is there is no one size fits all. There are many people wanting many different things.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Oh, gosh, this is such an interesting conversation, and I'm just being very mindful of time as well as we're close to finishing. So before I do finish, I do want to ask you a more personal question, and that's around what's one of the greatest lessons that you've learnt throughout your career about yourself?
Well, I think that goes to why I want to be surprised and want to be challenged, in that, you know, we all can get very hard and fast in our ideas, and I think that having preconceived ideas about something is something that I've really had to challenge myself on and have to still constantly do, because I think one of my problems is coming to stories with a preconceived idea about how that story is going to pan out. And given it was one of my great criticisms of journalism, that often the angle was decided before the journalist left the office. Mm. I think that, you know, there was no one great sort of hiatus moment where I learnt that lesson. Mm-hmm. But I certainly think that that's a lesson that I have learnt over time, is to be careful to prejudge. And I see that in so many ways. You know, I mean, even with the people that I work with, the people I train, I sometimes get a heads up from an in-house comms person saying, look, so-and-so will be very good and so-and-so will, you know, we're really going to have to do a real lot of work with them. And you get them in the room and completely the opposite is the case. Mm. That, you know, the person who came across as being the weaker performer turned out to be the much stronger performer, and often the most authentic performer, the most believable performer. The person who was perhaps just too slick to be believable. And so, you know, I've learned that lesson over time, but I think it's a lesson that I have to keep re-educating myself on.
That's such a beautiful, beautiful lesson, and I couldn't agree more, because I agree from experience too. I feel that everyone shows up differently for different people, so one person's experience of someone is not necessarily going to be the same for somebody else. And if we could just be a bit more mindful before making those judgments, whether it's on a professional or personal level, I think that's such a a beautiful reminder to take away for myself again and also for our listeners.
Because you can be so pleasantly surprised.
Oh, absolutely. And so easily and so quickly we can close ourselves off from having a very different experience.
Mm, exactly. And I think that, you know, experiences are what we're going to need to be chasing more and more.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for your time today. I could honestly sit down and chat with you all day. It's very, very, you have a very fascinating mind. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.